I work with this phenomenal NFL football analyst by the name of Mina Kimes, and listening to her talk about Patrick Mahomes' quick game just reminds me of her wit game, how witty she is. Because as soon as you think you become above reproach for a Mina Kimes joke, it comes like a gauntlet. Mina Kimes is definitely going to have a wit game on point, and I'm expecting to be caught off guard and probably looking stupid.
That is ESPN NFL analyst Marcus Spears pointing out something we're all too familiar with. Getting truck-sticked by Mina Kimes. Today, our friend Mina joins us to break down the climax of an NFL season, unlike any other. And yes, Super Bowl 55 is this historic quarterback matchup. But it's also a lot more. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, February 5th. This is ESPN Daily. So, Tampa. Mina Kimes is an NFL analyst at ESPN who is in Tampa, Florida, covering Super Bowl 55. Mina, when I first met you, many, many moons ago now, I have to say, you were an investigative business reporter who was dreaming about one day being this NFL analyst who got to go to Super Bowls. So I'm just curious, what kind of a dream is Tampa, Florida for you right now?
It's a surreal one, and I think it's surreal for literally everyone here right now. This is unlike any Super Bowl I've ever been to. Normally, thousands of people descend on a city. There's a media night where the players on, you know, the respective Super Bowl teams are interviewed. It's wacky. It's chaotic. It's exciting. There are puppets. And none of that's happening. I mean, there's still people here, but media night was conducted via Zoom. The Kansas City Chiefs, the football players, are not in Tampa. They're arriving on Saturday. So the whole thing is, to go back to my original descriptor, rather surreal.
So it feels instead, Mina, like all of the standard chaos of Super Bowl week has been replaced by a different sort of chaos, because we got reports this week that the Chiefs and Patrick Mahomes, their star quarterback, they narrowly dodged this potential coronavirus outbreak because their barber, midway through a haircut on offensive lineman Daniel Kilgore, their barber got the news that he had tested positive.
Now here's the kicker to the whole story. There were 20 players and employees, including Patrick Mahomes, who were lined up to get appointments that day. So there are close contacts in the COVID world, and there are close calls in the COVID world.
So as the NFL gets so close to officially pulling this whole season off, did it ever feel to you like the league wouldn't get here as cleanly as they did?
You know, weirdly, the answer is no, because the NFL has signaled from the very beginning of the season, Pablo, when they decided not to do a bubble and they came up with a very elaborate system of testing players on a daily basis, it was obvious to everyone in and around the league that they were going to forge on no matter what, even when you had quarterbacks testing positive or, you know, they were close contacts and you had backup quarterbacks starting games. That was Denver, as you remember, or right. Coaches in the playoffs, like Kevin Stefanski, who couldn't be there. The NFL has forged on. And I say that in a value neutral way. I don't think it's something to be necessarily entirely criticized or entirely applauded. It just is what it is. So throughout all of it, from weeks 1 through 16 through the playoffs, I have always felt that we would get to this point.
So I want to rewind with you now to week 12 in specific, because that is when the Buccaneers and the Chiefs played each other last, and that was in Tampa. And what happened?
Well, Tyreek Hill happened.
It's a really good Tampa defense. He's throwing it long. Gunning it long, Tyreek Hill holds it in at the 20, 15, 10, 5, touchdown! Kansas City, an explosive first quarter, 75-yard touchdown reception.
Specifically to poor Carlton Davis, who is a very good cornerback for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, but had a very bad day.
Mahomes throwing to that. Tyreek Hill over the shoulder, 15-yard line. He backflips into the end zone. Touchdown!
Tyreek Hill went off for over 200 yards in the first quarter, Pablo. And it got out of hand really quickly. The Bucs kind of caught up as the game went on. But for the most part, it was always in hand for Kansas City. And you saw Tampa make some of the mistakes that teams have made against Patrick Mahomes. Blitzing him, playing man, things that he's shredded. They pressed Tyreek Hill. Not something you want to do. But as the game went on, they played more soft zone. They made adjustments to cap that vertical attack. He's so fast and so deadly. And look, Kansas City, their offense was still efficient, but they moved the ball through Travis Kelce, Mahomes on the ground. In the end, obviously, it was enough. Whereas on the other side of the football, Tom Brady had a bit of a rough outing because you've seen all season, I've heard you and Bill talk about this on your podcast, how much he struggled under pressure. This was, according to ESPN's pass block win rate metric, which measures how long offensive linemen hold their blocks for at least 2.5 seconds. This was Tampa Bay's worst game of the season. Mm. They really struggled against the Chiefs pass rush. Tom Brady struggled as a result, and that's why they lost.
So it's going to be about 70 days between the Super Bowl and that loss you just dissected for us. How much have these teams changed in that time since?
I would say the Chiefs haven't changed very much. They look like the same offensive buzzsaw they appeared to be in Week 12. I think their defense has gotten a bit better, in particular the secondary in the AFC Championship. We talk a lot about Tyrann Mathieu, the Honey Badger, but Juan Thornhill, his fellow safety, was magnificent. And Steve Spagnuolo, who's been excellent against Tom Brady over the years, well, he used those players to great effect. I would say, though, the Bucs have evolved more, in particular, their offense. So through the first 12 games of the season, on 20-yard-plus passes, Tom Brady had 4 touchdowns and 5 interceptions. Since Week 14, he has 13 touchdowns on 20-yard-plus passes. He has been airing the ball out and airing it with great success.
Shotgun formation. Here comes pressure. Brady throws the ball toward the near sideline. Caught ball. Touchdown, Tampa Bay. It is Mike Evans.
They've also ran the ball pretty well. Leonard Fournette has been good in the postseason. And I think both of those components will be important in the Super Bowl.
So it does feel important to remember here, Mina, that the Buccaneers have been the underdog. I mean, we're going to talk about Tom Brady a lot as we get through this episode, but they've been the underdog through this path to get here. They upset the Saints and then the Packers in the NFC title game. So that win against Aaron Rodgers in particular, this enormous marquee victory, does it bode well for the Bucs in this game?
I would say yes and no. I'll start with the no. As much as I just praised Tom Brady and the offense and how well they've played over the last few weeks, he didn't really do a ton in this game. He was good in the first half, but in the second half, mostly it was just the Bucs offense capitalizing on turnovers created by the Bucs defense. And of course, he himself threw 3 interceptions. But what we did see, and what I think will be relevant in the Super Bowl, is Tampa Bay's pass rush heated up in a big way against a Green Bay offensive line that was down to their backups at tackle.
Shotgun set. Here's the snap. We put pressure on Price. Sacked! Back at the 13-yard line. Shaq Barrett has 2 today.
Well, I'm sure you've heard already a lot. Kansas City is also rolling out backups at tackle.
Yes.
And it's noteworthy that, especially against Patrick Mahomes, who is notoriously terrifying against the blitz, all 5 of Tampa Bay sacks in the NFC Championship were with a 4-man rush. So I think we're going to see a similar game plan to what we saw out of Tampa in the second half of Week 12 once they adjusted. A lot of 2-man, a lot of soft zone, not a lot of blitzes. They're really going to count on Shaq Barrett and JPP to get pressure up front.
So I want to zoom out here for a quick second, Mina, because I don't want to be numb to the fact that we're getting Tom Brady and Patrick Mahomes in the Super Bowl, but we've been talking about it for what feels like forever now.
Yeah.
And it is true. Like, we did not get Joe Montana playing Terry Bradshaw. We did not get Brett Favre against Peyton Manning in the Super Bowl context. As a football fan, as a football nerd, as someone who is excited about all of this, what does it mean to have Brady and Mahomes in this game together?
It means that we are giving, we, reality is giving Patrick Mahomes a shot at unseating Tom Brady as the quote unquote greatest of all time. And I use that term holistically. It's not about just talent. It's not about rings. It's not about, it's about all of those things.
Wait, holistically, I feel like you're lighting candles and you're talking about Tom Brady and Patrick Mahomes.
Well, if it was just about talent, I mean, I'll be straight up with you, Pablo. Patrick Mahomes is already the most talented quarterback I've ever seen. But Tom Brady is the GOAT because he has six rings and now he's angling for a seventh. And right now, Patrick Mahomes has one. So in the national conversation about these things, and of course we do this all the time with LeBron and Jordan,
yes,
when we evaluate Patrick Mahomes' career and we ask the question, does that career match what Tom Brady accomplished? This Super Bowl will mean something.
All right, that is a lot of heat. So after the break, we're going to take a look at how these two teams, more than just their quarterbacks,
thank you,
how they actually just match up on the field.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
So, Mina, I don't envy anyone trying to game plan to stop Patrick Mahomes in the Chiefs offense. I truly do not even know where you would begin, so I'm going to make you do that for us. Let's pretend you are Todd Bowles, the defensive coordinator of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. How do you begin to stop those skill players? How, I mean, can they even be stopped?
No, is the short answer. No, not fully. Some of the mistakes that Bowles and that defense made in the first game, in week 12, you saw him address those errors as the game went on. As I mentioned, they played less press man, particularly on Tyreek Hill. They're not going to do that again this time. They learned their lesson. But Pablo, like, when you watch Mahomes, other than the fact that, you know, he has this ungodly talent and doesn't play bad games, it's really hard to find defenses that have success against him. You know, when you cut up his splits, he looks good in every one of them.
Here's Mahomes, gets some pressure, man in his face. Got Hardman wide open for the touchdown. And Mahomes paid the price. Hit by Marlon Humphrey. Touchdown, Chiefs.
Doesn't matter if he's playing man. It doesn't matter if he's playing zone. It doesn't matter if he's under pressure. He's actually better under pressure. It's really unfair. Mm. But one thing that did jump out to me as I was preparing for this game is he has been better against single high coverage than two deep. What it means is they're not going to leave one safety in, you know, covering deep and have their corners sort of on islands against the wide receivers. They're more likely to have two safeties back there helping out the cornerbacks. And you've seen that formula a lot against Mahomes and this offense, frankly, because every defense, not every defense, but many defenses in the NFL have done the calculus and said, look, we'd rather have him carve us up underneath and run the ball than take deep shots. So I wouldn't be surprised if Tampa does the same. They'll probably bracket Tyreek Hill and Kelce. It gets a little more complicated, and this is why it's so hard to defend. It's like pick your poison.
I mean, Travis Kelce's the he's possibly the offensive player of the year, and that's like why, you're not gonna bracket him.
Yeah, and that's why I actually think he's more likely to produce in this game, because defenses have, when they've done the math, they've zeroed in on Tyreek Hill, saying, okay, we're going to stop him over the top. Now, Andy Reid has a counter to that, which is he uses Hill's speed horizontally. But Travis Kelce has a way of getting open no matter what sort of coverage you play.
Twist by the Browns up front. Slant. Cut Kelce at the 10. Five dives into the end zone. Touchdown! A brilliant catch and run by the best tight end in the league.
He finds the soft spots in zones. He regularly beats linebackers in man, something that happened a lot the last time these two teams played. So really, other than sitting back, not getting embarrassed and praying, there's not much you can do in coverage. I think Tampa Bay's best chance at stopping Mahomes is up front.
So if there is a weakness for Kansas City right now, Mina, it does feel like the offensive line and Eric Fisher, their starting left tackle. I mean, he tore his Achilles tendon in the AFC title game. It's an enormous loss, but it's also not just him. Mitchell Schwartz, their starting right tackle, has been injured since week six. And one of their starting guards from last season, Laurent Duvernay-Tardif, he is a doctor who opted out of the season to help on the front lines in Canada in the fight against COVID-19, which is its own amazing story. But with all of that in mind, how do you expect them to perform on Sunday?
If it was any team but Kansas City with their combination of quarterback, coach, wide receiver, tight end, this offensive line, the state that it's in, would be the end of any other offense, especially against a pass rush like Tampa. At this point, you're looking at a lineup where Austin Reiter, the center, he's the only player who's in the same position he played week one. They have been doing musical chairs across the line. And, you know, Mike Remmers, I think, has played like just about every position except for center on this offensive line at this point. He's going to get the start at left tackle. It's absolute madness. And it is the Bucs' best shot at a mismatch in this game because Tampa Bay has a phenomenal pass rush. They have had a lot of success hurrying quarterbacks, even when they don't blitz. They blitz at a very high rate. They did not in week 12, and I suspect they'll take a similar approach because of how terrifying Patrick Mahomes is against the blitz. He leads the NFL in QBR and has a touchdown interception ratio of 17-0, which is crazy. So the Bucs and Todd Bowles are going to really count on that four-man rush to get home, just like they did in the NFC Championship.
Yeah, it feels unfair when you like try to divide that fraction and it's literally undefined. Like, I'm sorry, Patrick Mahomes, you have broken math. But on the other side of that math, we do have Tom Brady. And there are some crazy stats we've come to appreciate in the last week or so. The craziest one is probably the fact that since he was drafted in 2000, he's played in 48% of all of the Super Bowls that have happened while he's been in the NFL. And I know it's not just about Tom Brady, but I do want to understand, how well is he actually playing right now?
Really well. And I know I just said he didn't do much in the second half of the NFC Championship, which is just true. But he's had a really great season. And it's been a really fun one to watch because all season long we've been asking, okay, how is he going to meld with Bruce Arians, no risk it, no biscuit offense? And while there's been, I guess, awkward transitions at times, not just with Brady and Arians and Byron Leftwich, who's the offensive coordinator, but also sometimes, especially early in the season, he's not been on the same page as the wide receivers. He's really flourished, especially throwing the ball deep. Now, typically, Pablo, quarterbacks in that Arians system, because they throw it deep so often, they throw a lot of interceptions, and that's not been the case with Tom Brady.
Brady flushed out of the pocket, looks downfield, throws downfield. It is caught! Touchdown, Tampa Bay! Antonio Brown!
I know he just threw three in the NFC Championship. Bear with me for the most part. He's protected the football and he's getting the ball out really quickly. And that combination of things, getting the ball out quickly, not throwing interceptions and not throwing it deep, that's very rare that all of those things happen at once. But Tom Brady, the ball's coming out hot. Last time they played the Chiefs, he actually had the quickest time to throw of any game this season. I anticipate it'll be the same. The question is, okay, will he be better prepared for the blitz this time than he was in week 12?
Well, in week 12, I mean, the Chiefs defense did blitz a lot and the Buccaneers lost, as we know, but Brady ended up throwing for 345 yards. So if you're Steve Spagnuolo, the Chiefs defensive coordinator, is that a strategy you're returning to again?
I think so, but the fun thing about Steve Spagnuolo is his game plans never look the same. Tom Brady has started 5 postseason games against Steve Spagnuolo as defensive coordinator, and his record in those games is 2-3. So, which is not something you usually associate with Tom Brady. Spags has had a lot of success putting together game plans against him, and he certainly did in Week 12. Now, I don't think the Chiefs defense is going to have as much success blitzing him as they did, say, Josh Allen, who looked very confused by where pressure was coming from and some of the pre and post snap deception. But Tom Brady has struggled this year against the blitz, and I don't think the Chiefs defense is going to take their foot off the accelerator in this game, especially since Chris Jones, defensive tackle, has been playing out of his mind.
So as we wrap up here, Mina, I need you to dig down and give us an X factor for Sunday's game.
So I think this is a fair answer because it's not too much of a deep cut.
Yeah, give me your most hipster first. Now, give me your most. What's your most hipster X factor?
Well, I think I'm really fascinated by Leonard Fournette. Playoff Lenny, he's called himself, because during the regular season, Pablo, I was frustrated sometimes with his usage. Ronald Jones, their other running back, he was better than him, and I thought they were using Fournette too much, and it was strange, but he's actually really flourished in the postseason. He had that incredible touchdown last week, breaking tackles left and right.
First down, 10, Bucks moving right hand off. So there's a little stutter step by Fournette, fights through a tackle, hits a block on the right side, and another block. He's inside the 10. Touchdown, Tampa Bay! Fournette refused to go down.
And one thing that's, I think, really notable about the Chiefs' defense is they're very good at defending wide receivers. They're less good at defending tight ends, but they're really, really bad at defending passes to running backs, second worst in the NFL. And 2 out of Leonard Fournette's 4 best games this year as a pass catcher have been in the postseason against the Saints and Washington. So I wouldn't be surprised if he has a key catch or 2 in this matchup.
So I feel like by definition then, Lenny, your dog, has the Buccaneers in this game. But we need a prediction from you, Mina. Who is going to win Super Bowl 55?
I wish I could go with Lenny in this one, but Patrick Mahomes is just too good. So I'm going Chiefs 31, Bucks 27.
Ooh, okay. All right. Writing that down. Writing that down to shame you later. Okay, that's noted.
I don't think I could choose 2 teams that I'd rather see play each other at this juncture based on what we've seen so far in the postseason. And Pablo, having said that, we are now doomed to a 10-6 game.
Mina Kimes, our hipster X Factor. I just want to make it clear for the record, we did know you before you were cool. Coming up, hear the story of a golf swing that is very literally out of this world.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Here's another story I want you to know. Think of any moment in sports history. It doesn't matter what it is, big or small. From the Olympics in ancient Greece to your weekend bowling league. From Roger Bannister and his first 4-minute mile to your kid's t-ball game. All those moments, they have one thing in common. They all happened on planet Earth. To date, there is just one example of sports taking place on another celestial body. And it happened 50 years ago tomorrow. February 6th, 1971. and it was broadcast all across America on live TV.
Houston, while you're looking that up, you might recognize what I have in my hand is the...
That audio sounds staticky because it's coming from nearly a quarter million miles away, from the surface of the moon. That's where astronaut Alan Shepard was standing by with a genuine six iron and a little white object, a golf ball.
Just so happens to have a genuine six iron on the bottom of it. In my left hand, I have a little white pellet that somebody in the millions of Americans.
Shepard was about to attempt the first ever lunar sand trap shot. The inspiration, he would later explain, came from his own experience on the terrestrial links.
Being a golfer, I was intrigued by the fact that the ball with the same club head speed will go six times as far. Its time of flight will be at least six times as long. It will not curve because there's no atmosphere to make it slice or hook. And I thought, what a neat place to whack a golf ball.
We wanted to know more about Shepard's shot heard round the galaxy, so we called up someone back on Earth. Victoria Neno, senior historian at the USGA Golf Museum and Library in Liberty Corner, New Jersey, where our world's most famous six iron now resides.
So the Moon Club is really special. It's comprised of two different parts. So the club head is a regular six iron, a Wilson six iron club head. It's looks just like one you might find in your garage or the back of your car. And the second part is what makes it really special. So it's a retractable aluminum and Teflon shaft, and it can be broken apart in five pieces and is connected by a string. And the original intent of this shaft would be to collect lunar rock and dust samples, and you would attach a sort of scoop on the end of it as you went about your experiments on the surface of the moon. And so Alan Shepard selected this instrument that he measured to be the length of a six iron, and then visited a local head pro at the River Oaks Country Club in Houston and asked him to create a six iron club head that would attach on to this shaft.
So how did Shepard get the club onto the moon?
This was really done in secret. He had done a lot of practicing in his large, bulky spacesuit at NASA in Houston beforehand, making sure he could pull off the feat in a professional way. He would don that spacesuit with the oxygen tanks and the radios and all of his other equipment and practice a sort of one-handed shot in order to feel prepared. And then he basically smuggled the six iron club head and two golf balls in a sock into his spacesuit. And everything is weighed very precisely on a spacecraft. So this was something that he felt didn't make too much of a difference. And then that's how he got the materials on the spacecraft.
So the day February 6th, 1971, I want to go back there in the time machine with you. What happened on that day?
So if we travel back into our time machine, we arrive on the lunar surface, and Shepard and his fellow astronauts had been conducting different experiments on the surface of the moon, testing different rock samples, taking different measurements, assessing different scientific qualities about the moon's surface. And so they were just wrapping up a lot of their experiments. It had been a very successful mission, but he had received permission to go about the golf shot if everything had gone successfully. So right before we're about to hit the moonshot there with Shepard, he's just basically gotten to a point where he feels like everything in the mission has gone really successfully.
So when he is taking his swing and he's trying to hit this ball, I'm wondering if you could describe that scene for us, like what it actually looked like.
Shepard brings two golf balls with him. So there were two shots that he took that went far enough that he didn't retrieve them. But that didn't mean there were a couple other swings that happened in between.
I'm going to drop it down, but I'm going to try a little sand trap shot here.
So there are a couple chunks in there. He kind of takes a first little bit of a whiff at the first one. Then he ends up hitting it, and he said he shanked it into a crater about 40 yards away.
That looked like a slice to me, Al.
You know, there's a little reaction like that looked like a slice to me, Al, over the radio. And then he sort of resets himself, drops that second ball.
Three to die, one more.
And he connects with that one. He said that he hit the ball down moon against the black sky so he could see how far it had traveled and watched its trajectory. And he famously said that that shot went for miles and miles and miles. In reality, it probably traveled about 200 to 220 yards just because he had measured out some other experiments about that distance away the day before. So he could kind of judge the distance of the shots.
So are the balls somewhere still on the moon?
So Shepard said in an interview in 1974, so just a few years later, that he believed the balls probably had already disintegrated due to the wide swings in temperature that the moon can experience, you know, negative degrees Fahrenheit and extremely hot weather all the way in the other direction. So the balls are probably not there, but, you know, the dust from them, I'm not sure. But he never revealed the brand of golf ball that he hit up there. He never wanted anyone to profit off of his shots. No one knows the brands that he took up there.
I don't want to be too dramatic here, Victoria, but it strikes me that in the entire history of sports and humankind, that golf club kind of represents the only time that sports took place somewhere other than planet Earth. So what does it feel like to care for this utterly singular piece of sports memorabilia?
It's a huge responsibility and one that we take very seriously. And, you know, this is an artifact that means so much to so many people. And we really view our care of golf history as caring for cultural history and shared collective history of people, not just a very specific sport or a specific time, but the stories and legacies of people that, you know, have touched millions throughout all times in history. So though this club, it certainly represents so much, it's just a piece of kind of all the amazing parts of sports history and what it means to people.
Victoria, thanks so much for explaining one of the most fascinating objects in the world of sports.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great speaking with you.
After he returned to Earth, Alan Shepard would go on to be something of a golf icon. He reportedly had an 8 handicap, and he appeared regularly in celebrity tournaments before passing away in 1998. His ashes were scattered near his home of Monterey, California, in Stillwater Cove, by the shores of Pebble Beach Golf Course, right next to the 17th hole. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Happy Belated Birthday MJ, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Andy Tennant, Eve Tro, Chris Tumanello, and Aaron Vale. Special thanks this week to Sania Blue, Andres Soto, Isabel Lopez, Garrett Lang, Max Brodsky, Troy Farkas, and Jackson Ugelo. I'll talk to you Monday.